as a result of writing this book and thinking about it, and to talk and talking to all the people that I've spoken to, I've selected the word and used the word Ongwehungwe, because I think what it does is it conveys the sense of really who we should be and what we should be striving to be. There's different ways of describing ourselves, First Nations, or I'm First Nations, I'm Indigenous, I'm an Indian, I'm whatever. And all of those carry with them a whole complex of ideas, and carry with them an identity. I think that even if you're critical of it, you have to buy into it just by using that word, because other people respond to you in that way. And you at least have to react to them and deflect them. Whereas Ongwehungwe, if we start using that word, it comes from our language. And here's an opportunity to do a kind of Foucaultian or postmodern thing, which is to create a new understanding in English language about what it is to be Indigenous, First Nations, and all those other words. Ongwehungwe, if we use that in English, if we say, that's who I am, that's what I am, and inform that through our scholarship, our speaking, and our work, and an example of our lives, we will have, I think, decolonized the English language a little bit, and the understanding of Canadians who now know that word for what it truly is through the example and the scholarship that we do. That's the way I would describe myself. And then in English, I would say, yeah, I'm trying to recover that word warrior. I think it's very important. And it's not a gendered macho concept and all that, and hopefully the book does a good job of dispelling any notions of that, although I do profile some pretty gendered macho guys. But I also profile some very sensitive grandmotherly type people who spend their life teaching languages on the reserve, who are not macho in any way, but carry the power of the woman. And I would say that they are, actually, they're the majority of the people that I interviewed are women, in a conscious attempt to undermine the notion of it being a macho male thing. And I think that that's very important, because what is the essence of the warrior? The warrior is someone who takes him or herself out of that place that he or she feels safe and comfortable, and goes into that dangerous space for reasons of self-sacrifice and honor, to protect the people from the threats that they face. Now, you can use that basic definition for someone teaching language. You can use that definition for someone trying to raise their kids in a way that's different than the mainstream would have them come out. You can take that as the classic, you know, military person who puts himself in a physical space of danger to protect the people. To me, that's the essence of being a warrior, and that's what I'm trying to recover. So yeah, it's interesting in the context of our history and our community to say that, because, you know, people in the warrior society, there's some of them that were true warriors. There's some who are not. There's some people who work for the band council that are true warriors, and there's some who not. Some who are not. So it's to transcend all of that, you know, all of that divisive politics, and to try to get our people to see things again in a unified way where we should be going. And I think that to say that as a mother, as an intellectual, as a professor, as a writer, as an iron worker, we should all strive to be warriors, I think that's a good thing. And that's what I hope that the book conveys. And just to give people a sense of it, at the end, I don't think I could find a better quote than someone who's not even a Native American. I mean, it comes, I think, from Gandhi, the last quote, which is about, and when I started writing, let me tell you this, when I started writing the book, I didn't like Gandhi, because I thought he was too much of a pacifist. But then by the end of the book, I respected that philosophy and that approach more than anything else, because it was an ethic of courage to the max, basically, you know. And now I have him finishing off the book saying, you know, you have to live like a warrior, and I can't do the direct quote, but living like a warrior, it's the struggle that you define yourself in, not the achievement. So I think where we are now, in our history, in the where we stand as communities, with our divisions, with the precarious existence that we live as Ongwehungwe, with all of the threats that are still out there, the biggest enemy we face is complacency. And so to define a role for a person as a warrior in that Gandhian sense of always being committed to the struggle, to decolonize internally, and to put yourself in a uncomfortable, dangerous place in whatever work you do, to me, that's the message that I want to send to the younger people, and also to the people who are involved in politics now, is that it's not a situation, it's not justifiable to relax or to be satisfied. And I saw a poster, it was in Arizona. There was a native artist, she was a Diné, a Navajo, and she did a really good job. I wish I had it with me, but and it had a painting that she had done, and part of on the outside of the frame it said, beware the Indian bureaucrat who is satisfied. You know, and to me that summed up what the enemy is today. It's our own satisfaction and our own complacency with accepting where we are today. Like as if having adequate housing, as if having cars, as if having decent clothes and money to go on vacation and all these things is enough. It's kind of irrelevant to the point that we should be striving, I think, for transcendence. And we should be striving, I think, for something that is defined in spiritual terms that would elevate our existence and not keep us bound to the realities that we live today. It came to me that, and I say it didn't come to me in some kind of mystical way, but it came to me in the sense that I was told so many times that I'd have to be really, really dumb to not get the point after speaking to so many people, that it's a process of regenerating ourselves, it's a process of transformation that is going to lead to our freedom from colonization. And this may strike some people as I use the word mystical, it may strike some people as spiritual, it may strike some people as kind of hearkening back to a religious kind of experience that people go through when they transcend something, to use those kind of words, transcendence, regeneration, and so forth. And I think there is elements of that type of process that need to happen in terms of understanding who we are and what we've become as a process, as a result of the history that we've lived as a community and as a people and as individuals. But I'm also applying it in a very political way, and in terms of being a social movement as well, is that when I say regenerative, what I'm saying is that we need to take the basic building blocks of an existence from the history, the culture, the languages, and the spiritual beliefs that we have as people, and remake them into something that is a path forward out of the colonized existence that we're living to a different kind of existence. It's to say that we should not take paths that have been laid out for us by one or other of the people inside of that problem of colonialism that I identified earlier. So whether it's the economic development person trying to empower us, whether it's the person who hates authority and wants to confront it physically with arms, or whether it's the person who believes in indigenous rights or Aboriginal rights and wants us to take part in that, we need to create our own path. That's basically what I'm saying. We need to create our own path, and thus far we haven't had any path laid out for us to pursue. And so it's a challenge that's laid out for, I want to say, our political leaders, but it's not really. It's a challenge for all of us to understand that in order to have any hope of reconstituting ourselves as nations, as healthy communities, as healthy humans, out of the colonial existence that we're living, we need to think about it in terms of regeneration, transformation, and then take from our traditions, our heritage, the philosophies that form a heritage of political knowledge, of spiritual practices, and so forth, build from that a movement that's capable of fundamentally challenging the colonial reality. And that's not to just challenge the land ownership system or not challenge the government system, but to challenge the reality of the way people live in a colonized existence, and really recreate for ourselves the kind of existences that our ancestors, I presume, enjoyed. Now, we weren't around to know, but all signs are and all indicators are that they lived healthier lives than we live, and happier lives than we live. And I think that's something that we can all agree on, whether we're Cree, Mohawk, Wet'suwet'en, or wherever we're from, or non-Indigenous living in this world here today. It's becoming apparent to anybody who sits and thinks about it for a while and looks inside that this kind of life that we're living is not healthy. It's not healthy spiritually, intellectually, and physically. And so how do we overcome that? I've been talking about that for the last, half an hour, 40 minutes now. And I guess where I leave it in the book is where I'll leave it here, which is that we need to put our minds together, and it's not for me as a theorist, and it's not for any one of our political leaders to lay out a model or an agenda or an ideology with a set of checkpoints and do this, this, and this, and you'll be happy. It's in essence saying that we all need to examine and overcome the effects of colonization in our own lives and recommit to building societies that are reflective of the values that our ancestors live. And that means challenging in just about every way the kind of lives that the state would have us live here today.